At Outback Steakhouse, your wish is our command. Backed by popular demand, steak and lobster at a special price starting at $19.99. Come enjoy our bold center-cut sirloin seasoned with our signature blend of 17 spices and paired with a buttery, succulent lobster tail. Hurry in to Outback Steakhouse where your steak and lobster wishes come true at a price you can't miss. Steak and lobster, starting at $19.99. No rules, just right.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Welcome back to True Crime IRL. I'm Kelly Behrens Brink, and this is part three of my series that I did with Bob Mata and Darren Wood of the Defense Diaries podcast, where we are diving deep into the Anthony Garcia case. Garcia is convicted of killing four people over several years in the Omaha, Nebraska area. And technically, that makes him a serial killer. But was he really a serial killer, or was he just a jaded psychopath with a specific hit list seeking revenge on Creighton University? And did he really even commit these murders at all? That's the million-dollar question. If you haven't listened to parts one and two of my series yet, go back and do that first, and then come back here because we are diving deeper into the crimes, into the killer's MO, and into the trial with Bob Mata from Defense Diaries. And we will get into all of that in just a moment, but first, a quick word from our sponsors. And now, back to the show.
Was one of them the vehicle and that yes. Anthony's dad owned that vehicle or owned a similar vehicle?
Well,
from
my client's perspective, it was even worse. Anthony had once owned that vehicle.
Okay.
And actually owned that vehicle back in 2008. And I think in like 2012 or 2011, he had given that vehicle to his parents.
Okay.
Who still had it. Like, so... Because when, and we're kind of jumping all over the place, but when they arrested Garcia, it was a joint task force with the feds and Omaha PD, you know, they had a lot of cops on this thing. So when they nailed him, you know, it was an orchestrated bust. You know, they had been following him, tracking him, pinging him. And so when they made the decision to pull him over, they had people ready in California at both his sister's house and his parents' house to effectuate search warrants there. They had people in Indiana that were ready to get into his home in Indiana to
effectuate.
So yeah, it all happened.
Quite an orchestrated endeavor there.
Yeah, it all happened like right at the same time. So they knew, you know, they knew that they were taking him down like at that time and that date.
So what were the other two smoking gun things you were talking about?
So you have the first smoking gun. So before we go there, let me briefly. So okay. Hunter goes cold. Okay. 5 years, and they really did investigate the hell out of it. You know, like when I came into the case, I got 15 binders filled with their investigation. So they did a lot of police work. Like it mattered. This was like a family that mattered to them. It was in a community that, you know, that mattered. So they really investigated the hell out of it, and they just couldn't make the link. So fast forward to Mother's Day of 2013, this nice older couple, the Brumbecks, the state's timeline is that, you know, between 4:15, 4:45 on Mother's Day, that an intruder comes, knocks on the door. Roger Brumbeck opens the door. He is shot four times from an intruder who is standing outside of the house, and he shoots into the house. The intruder then steps over Brumbeck's body. Mrs. Brumbeck had run to the kitchen to arm herself with a knife. Mm-hmm. The again, the killer grabs another knife from the kitchen, and a knife fight ensues between Mary Brumbeck and the killer. Mary Brumbeck is stabbed in excess of 35 times.
Wow.
29 of them in her hands. So you know that's defensive wounds.
Yeah.
You know, she's fighting, trying to keep it. Like, she was fighting for her life. Mm-hmm. And I can only imagine, like, when I try to envision that scene, like how it was going down when I was preparing for the case. Well, I mean, let me ask you, would you, you know, if somebody had just shot your husband, he's laying dead, he's chasing you around with a knife, he's stabbing you repeatedly in the hands, you're fighting for your life. I mean, would you be screaming bloody murder? Like, I mean, just like instinctually, I mean, do you think that you would?
Probably.
Right. I mean, to me, like when I think about that, you know, I don't know that you'd be saying things that were necessarily clear and concise.
No.
I think that you would be screaming.
Probably.
Like help or just anything that you could
right.
just, or just screaming at the top of your lungs, like screaming literally bloody murder.
I would think.
Right. You know, so their timeline was always an issue for me. So the Brumbecks are then killed I think that was the 13th as well, but it was definitively a Mother's Day, and it was in May. First beautiful day of the spring, you know, which if you kind of imagine a Mother's Day at about 4:30 in a kind of another bedroom community, probably a lot of barbecues going on. It was a beautiful day. I think it was like low 70s.
Out. Perfect.
Perfect day, you know.
Family like gatherings.
Everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so that timeline always haunted me. I always had a big problem with it, because to have four gunshots being fired from outside of the house into the house and not one witness.
Nobody heard it.
No one heard it.
That can't be.
That can't be. So, you know, and these are the things like when you talk about California Dreaming and Generation Y, that they simply, because Todd Cooper, who wrote the book that most of these shows are using as their reference, simply didn't bring our evidence in that we, mm-hmm. that we entered into evidence that we thought was incredibly compelling. And, you know, that story has just never been told. So like I'm going to start it here today with you. Kind of delving into, you know, kind of the defense side of it, because this thing is not as clear cut as it is. Todd Cooper likes to make it seem that it was.
And we are jumping around a little bit, so I have to apologize to our listeners, but it's really hard not to be jumping around because there is so much to cover, and there are so many rabbit holes this case will bring you down, and it's just so much to it. So
it is. And, you know, so, but kind of to nutshell it, so we've got the hunters. Young Thomas Hunter and Shirley Sherman killed in 2008 in March. And then fast forward 5 years, and then you go to the Brumbecks, who were killed on Mother's Day of 2013. Mm-hmm. And like you had said just prior to me kind of jumping into the Brumbecks, at that point, they make the Creighton connection.
Okay? Yeah.
They see that because Roger Brumbeck was either the chair or the director of the department, and Hunter had either been the director or the chair. They were both very high ranking within the department. They then at that point say, okay, well, there's the connection. So yes, they didn't kill Stephen Hunter, the father, but they killed his son, and he obviously was employed by Creighton. So we've also got Brumbeck, who obviously was, again, employed at Creighton. So they had that connection. So they then go, Derek Moise and other cops from OPD go to Creighton, and they say, look, we've kind of discovered there's a connection between this cold case from 5 years ago and this Brumbeck killing, and we need a list of everyone that's had a beef of any kind with anybody, either on staff or they were fired or they filed a lawsuit, whatever. Whatever the kind of beef is, we need those names, and we're going back, you know, 25 years.
Yeah.
Like, we want like a comprehensive list of anyone.
Mm-hmm. And this is where the dramatic music starts playing in my head, because there was one name on multiple lists that they were.
There were a couple of names.
That repeated on everyone's list?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, there was a Russian guy.
The Russian. I remember that. Yeah.
Michael Belenky.
Okay.
Who really had beef with mm-hmm. Creighton. Really, really had beef. Like, the whole Belenky thing was eerie. Like this guy, I really liked him for the Brumback thing. Like he had serious beef with Creighton. He had been terminated. You know, he had made some really weird phone calls to like Omaha PD, you know, like after he heard about, you know, after he heard about Brumback getting mm-hmm. killed, you know, cause they were looking into Belanky hard.
So rewind a little bit for people who aren't aware of who the Russian is. Who was this person? What was his connection?
He was another resident of the program.
Okay.
You know, and he was there, you know, at the same time that Garcia was, but he was in the program for a longer period of time. He was terminated from the program. He ended up moving to the, like, kind of the Great Northwest, like up around Seattle, like on the border of Canada, and was kind of living like in uncharted territory. He was like kind of living
like off the grid, kind
off
of
the grid, yeah. kind of thing. And, yeah. and you know, so they were looking hard and like he actually ended up getting a gig up in Canada as a medical examiner, like a chief medical examiner. And he had a bunch of issues up there. Like he was screwing up like
the autopsies. Is this the one? Okay.
Yeah, this is that guy.
Okay.
And so Belanky, you know, so when they're trying to look at his alibi for the date in question in terms of the Brumback killings, it really didn't stand up. And when we did a lot of investigation into that, and it, you know, it turned out that the time cards that he had signed, because every time that they would have to go in and, you know, perform autopsies, they obviously indicated it on a sheet. So his sheets did not hold up at all. Like became clear that he had said that he was there, but he was not there that day.
So he was falsifying records.
Yeah, he absolutely was.
An attempt to provide right. himself an alibi.
Yeah, he was. And so we were all over him, like as a defense team. We were like this Belanky guy, you know, and in like this call that he made, and I don't know if it was to Derek Moise or not, but you know, it was very eerie. It was something to the effect of like, oh, you know, like I heard the Brumbecks got murdered. He's like, you know, that's really unfortunate, you know, because in the cops, like they, Omaha had spared no expense in investigating these cases. Like they had traveled up to Canada. They spent the money to go like investigate him. So they were looking hard at Belanky. He wasn't like a cursory suspect. He was a person of interest. So at that point, basically when they get the list, Belanky's one of the guys on there. Garcia is one of the guys on there. You know, there were a few names. So Derek Moise, just by kind of luck of the draw, draws Anthony Garcia's name. And what they did with almost everybody on the list, and if you're not aware, you don't have to be charged in order for the police to subpoena your bank and telephone records.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So, and to be honest with you, I did not either until I got this case. You know?
You can just be a person of interest and
they can subpoena your bank records. They can
start going through your life with a magnifying glass.
Exactly. So Moise, you know, kind of like, you know, picking a name out of the hat, got Garcia. So that was one of the guys that he was looking at. Subpoenas his bank records, subpoenas his phone records, and he gets two hits. He sees that, number one, that Anthony Garcia was in Omaha on the day because his phone had pinged, his GPS had pinged. So he was in Omaha on the day of the Brumback killing.
What reason would he have to be in Omaha? Because didn't he live in Indiana at the time?
He did. We'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that. And he also had drawn out money from an ATM like a couple days before, like $600, I think, or something like that. So, but it was his presence in the state that really got Omaha to say, all right, this guy, because that was the first question they asked. Why was he in Omaha? Like, what reason did he have to be in Omaha on that day? So they liked him immediately. So they, you know, and one of my beefs with how they handled the investigation was, if he becomes a person of interest, you know, and they've kind of got that kind of strong circumstantial evidence, you know, because mere presence is never enough. You can't just have it that, oh, well, he was in the state, so we think he's the murderer. Mm-hmm. Got to have more than that. I mean, it's certainly creating a little smoke to where you're like, oh, okay, well, this guy doesn't really have any discernible reason to be here. The problem that I had with Omaha is that they never asked him. Like, he was never questioned, ever. To me, the first move would have been, okay, we just subpoenaed his records. We know that he was here. Why don't we find out what his explanation is as to why he was in Omaha?
And they didn't do that?
That never took place.
They just said, you're under arrest? Or what? No, I mean,
so,
no.
So, when, I mean, essentially, but there's a period of time where they're investigating, where they're digging into him.
Right.
You know, kind of trying to get as much information as they can about him, going back to Creighton and getting as much information as they can about him, about like what went on in his, you know, career at Creighton, you know, like what was his beef? Like, was his beef of such an extent that it might drive him to kill, you know, right. 5 years after the fact? So, remember, this is 2001. No, 7 years after the fact is like it was like that type of gap between Hunter and when he's fired. And then, you know, we're talking 12 years. You know, after he's fired, that if he's the guy, came back and he kills the Brumbecks. I mean, that's a hell of a grudge.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
So what exactly was the beef with each of those individuals? So he was fired by who led that? Hunter?
See, but that's the thing. No, like that's what I was telling you yesterday. You know, I mean, he had his issues at Creighton that we talked about yesterday. You know,
right.
The thing with the, you know, with Boutra and the weirdo prank that he did where he's,
right.
You know, but Hunter still, even at that point, didn't terminate him. You know, he gave him the opportunity to resign. And but moreover, what even flies more in the face of the state's narrative is the fact that Hunter wrote him the letter and got him his next residency at UIC. You know, I mean, like without Hunter, he's not getting that. So it's like when you're kind of looking and he screwed that up, he being Garcia, you know, but that was no fault of Hunter's. You know, Hunter just got him the gig and then he went and screwed that up all on his
own. Right.
You know what I mean? So like, as far as like having a beef with Hunter, it just didn't add up to me. Like, and it still doesn't add up to me. It just is one of those things where like the guy, despite how much this guy screwed up, he still didn't terminate him. And moreover, and more importantly, he got him his next gig in another residency at a reputable school.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not like he had to go down to, you know, some kind of medical school in Mexico.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, he went to UIC. It's not Harvard by any stretch of the imagination, but it's certainly a reputable program. You know, so like I always had that beef kind of with that portion of their narrative, because that the whole revenge thing was their whole theory. Their entire theory of the case was that him being fired, which wasn't accurate, you know, from that Creighton thing just caused him to spin off. That he could never recover in terms of his career, you know, and that
which
he was destitute.
I mean, and that's not true at
it's
all.
It's not true. I mean, he owned a home. I think he had like an older model Ferrari or Lamborghini.
Yeah, he had like two. He had, right.
I mean,
yeah, a couple nice cars.
This guy was not destitute, and he spent a ton of money at strip clubs. I mean, we laugh, but you know,
that ain't cheap.
That ain't cheap. That's an expensive hobby to have, you know.
A hobby. I love
that. Yeah. You know, I mean, the girls are, you know, they're good at their job typically, and they can extract money from people pretty well. So, you know, you have to imagine he was spending quite a bit of dough in there. And, you know, so he wasn't destitute. And like I had said yesterday, he is not the guy that at age 7 decided, oh, I'm going to go to Harvard Medical School and I want to be one of the finest doctors that's ever graced the planet. Like, that wasn't him. Like, he had tried to go to law school first. Didn't do well on the LSATs, kind of like decided, screw it. I'll take the MCAT or whatever it is for medical school. And, you know, did well enough to get accepted out in Utah and decided to go to medical school. And, you know, his parents were both working class folks. His father was a postal worker, retired, had worked for decades. Mother was an RN, you know, wonderful, wonderful people, you know, who I got to know. Like very intimately, you know, in terms of like dealing with them and trying to save their son for 3 years. And, you know, his brother, same deal. Like they, like everyone in the family was just completely normal. You know, and in terms of kind of what we were talking about yesterday, when you're trying to dig into these folks to see if there's like hints from their past as to like what would have led them down this road to, you know, is, can it possibly be that this guy is the guy that they're saying that he is, you know?
No, as a younger person, did he have any signs of mental illness? Didn't he have a little something in his background?
He had, I mean, I think at most it would have been diagnosed as depression. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there was certainly no like huge red flag, you know, like manic depressive type things. He didn't have any kind of psychotic episodes like that. You know, like I told you yesterday, I think that he did suffer from like serious migraines, you know, but he played football for, I think, all 4 years of high school. You know what I mean? So, and like we were kind of talking about yesterday with the kind of head trauma that seems to be a running theme with a lot of serial killers, that, you know, a lot of them have suffered head trauma at some point in their lives.
Definitely. Every case I've ever covered, there's been that common denominator of past head trauma, concussion.
Which seems to me like that would be such a big hint for people that are studying that type of shit, like that are trying to figure out what maybe makes these people tick. Mm-hmm. Like for that to kind of go, and maybe I'm just not knowledgeable and maybe they are digging into that. I just certainly have not seen tons of studies done about that link, about the head trauma then maybe affecting somebody in the sense that, you know, maybe that is the triggering effect of what turns them into what they ultimately become. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, as we know, there are no giant strides being made in the mental health field really at all. I mean, it's definitely something they need to look into and study more and give more focus to. But yeah, every case I've covered has had an aspect of head trauma, migraines, things like that. Especially a lot of the crazy like pro wrestling cases I've covered, like Chris Benoit and Jimmy Snuka, and they all had those previous head injuries as well. So
I mean, you know, whoever kind of you kind of lay in terms of your view of professional wrestling, you know, there's always been that debate that, you know, oh, it's fake. Well, I mean, that may be true in terms of the outcome, but in terms of their athleticism and in terms of, you know, the maneuvers that they're pulling on each other and the you know, the violence that exists within that sport, that's very real.
There are very real injuries that happen.
No question about it. So, you know, I think that the only aspect of wrestling that may have been, you know, like fake in terms of scripted was probably like the outcome, you know, so they kind of had like a narrative or a story going with that. But yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff, I'm sure that these professional wrestlers were getting concussed constantly.
Yeah.
You know?
And I just did another case. Ronald Exantis was a semi-pro football player, and he had a lot of head injury too from his past, and murdered a six-year-old child just in a like psychotic state. So
yeah, and it's you know, I mean, it's kind of like it's a never-ending growing list of professional guys that, you know, Aaron Hernandez, the former tight end from the Patriots, like, you know, he just lost his shit, you know, and became like, I mean, a guy who was set financially for no apparent reason, just became murderous. You know, you have like Junior Seau. Long list, you know,
and
like
this
Sean
is
Gale was a safety
totally
for the Bears. And you know, the one common denominator is that all of them, when they studied their brains after the fact, they found that they all had CTE.
yeah,
you know, so I mean, that's clearly, you know, an unavoidable link. I think that's what finally pushed the NFL, and it took a lot of bullying to get them to the position, because there's so much money at stake. You know, the NFL starts worrying, are we viable? You know, if, you know, if they're going to determine that this is an incredibly hazardous sport for people to play, you know, it then becomes the question of, well, okay, people are making that decision to do so with the knowledge going in, then that's on them. But, you know, is it going to start limiting the pool of, you know, potential players that will actually, like, I probably never would have allowed my kid to play football, like, knowing what I know now in terms of the brain injuries that take place. You know, 'cause when I played, you know, they used to call it ringing your bell, you know,
it's
you'd hit your, you know, you'd literally see the stars when you had a head-on head collision. And it's like, you know, you'd literally I'd be woozy, mm-hmm. you know, and I realize now that I had suffered a concussion, mm-hmm. you know, but, you know, shake it off, you know, get in there for the next play, you know?
Yeah.
So that went like unchecked forever.
Right.
You know, up until very right. recently.
So,
know?
Yeah, that's something they definitely have to, I mean, that's just, we're coming up with these in a few minutes of just sitting here, but there are so many, even your guy, John Wayne Gacy.
Totally. Yeah.
He had
suffered
that
a head
too.
Injury when he was a kid.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, like Gacy and Garcia didn't really show any of the early signs, like, you know, like the head on a stick type of animals and torturing animal type stuff that a lot of these guys do.
Yeah.
You know, neither of them like kind of were into that.
No animal torture, no fire starting, no bedwetting, none
yeah,
of that.
Like, and Garcia was like, for all intents and purposes, a pretty normal kid. You know, it was like he was not antisocial. He, you know, was a sweet kid. You know, he played sports in high school. You know, he dated girls. He was like a normal kid. And like something at some point, if he's the guy, kind of sent him off the rails. Now, you know, I mean, and even if he is the guy or if he's not the guy, either way you kind of look at it, he was a strange dude.
Yeah.
Like when I met him, he was a strange guy, you know. But to me, you know, anyone that would have the opportunity to kind of select what area of medicine that they'd want to practice in and tends to gravitate towards forensic pathology, like where you're dealing with dead people's kind of a weird dude to begin with.
I agree. And Garcia and the Russian. Well, this floors me a little bit and it's a little unsettling how many wackadoodles there are in the, becoming doctors, like talking about Dr. Death and yesterday. And then these two, they had like some mental issues and whatever. They are just kind of odd ducks. Didn't get along with people.
Yeah. And it's, I can't remember if I was talking to you this about it off air or on air, but you know, what happened within 2 months of this case, kind of getting on the trial track is that, you know, Illinois, in terms of their licensing committees, you know, obviously contacted us as his counsel and said, look, we're suspending his license, obviously. And we said, yeah, we understand that. I mean, we're not necessarily going to, you know, fight it at this point. Plus he's incarcerated with no bond and he's going to be in there for a while. So, you know, I mean, do what you're going to do. But what that ultimately ended up doing is they changed the law in Illinois because I think we did do it on air, but the licensing boards were handling everybody, you know, hairdressers, real estate agents,
yeah,
you know, everyone's and doctors. You know, so they started to realize in real short order that they had to change that, that there had to be way more oversight when you're talking about doctors in terms of licensing. So that actually, that Garcia changed that law in Illinois. Mm-hmm. So kind of going back, so we've got, and you had asked kind of what were the circumstantial evidence. So there's the ping on the phone that puts Garcia in the area of Omaha. Okay, so they've got that, and then as they start digging in and they're obviously refreshing their recollection as to the Hunter killings, so they start looking at all these different things, and then they get the second piece of circumstantial evidence, which was the Honda CRV. So they see that Anthony Garcia owned, I want to say it was I can't remember the year, it might have been a 2003 Honda CRV. But that he owned it at the same time that the Hunter killings had taken place. So that was like a huge red flag for them. They're like, okay, so the guy's in Omaha on the day of the Brumbeck killings. He owned a CRV. We've got this Mary Raffle Ganger, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name right because I don't have it in front of me, but it's something very close to that. You know, we have her spotting this vehicle that is the same make and model as what he owns. So they've got those two things going for them right there. And then a few days after the murder takes place of the Brumbecks, Omaha PD gets a phone call from this doctor, Chandra Boutra, who says, you know, I don't know if this has anything to do with anything. You know, I really don't, but you know, I know that there's been this link made with Creighton, And I just wanted to let you guys know that on Mother's Day, around 2:30 in the afternoon, that my house alarm was triggered. And, I happened to be out at a Mother's Day brunch with my family, so we weren't home. And, we had been having some problems with that back door where it doesn't lock all the way. It's like a double door like this. And there's been occasions where, the wind has blown it open because it's not a securely fashioned door. So much so to the extent that we ended up pushing a couch in front of that door so the door wouldn't blow open anymore. But, our alarm went off. We didn't really think much of it. We thought, again, it was the wind that had just blown the door ajar and that, it got alerted. They called us. We said, we're fine. We're out at lunch. And then, and then I see this story break in the news. And, I just thought maybe you would want to look into it a little bit, right?
Because what was her affiliation with Anthony Garcia? They had something from the past, right?
Yeah, so she's the instructor that he had the beef with. Like a vocal, screaming match with her. Like, where he was certainly the aggressor, Anthony always felt like he was being discriminated against because of his race. And Butra was Indian or Pakistani, so she was a person of color as well.
Right.
So that didn't necessarily, make much sense in terms of Anthony feeling like he was being picked on, singled out because he was Hispanic. They just did not get along. Their personalities did not mesh. And that was where Hunter had gone to him and he said, look, that's your instructor. You have to apologize to her. And he refused to do so. And that was kind of the last straw, right? So immediately when they're digging through the Creighton file, them being the Omaha PD, they see notated in his file this beef with Butra. So what they do next is they go over and they dust for prints and they look for DNA samples. So off the handle of the back door, they were able to pull a very degraded small DNA sample off that, and they sent it off to the lab for testing. So at that point, by the time my client was arrested, they had gotten results back saying that he could not be excluded as being the provider of that DNA that they found on Butra's door. So at that point, in terms of probable cause, which is what they needed to keep him under arrest and to get it to move past the initial stage of the trial stage, where you have to show the judge that there's probable cause for them to move forward to trial, they had the car, they had the mere presence, and they had the Butra stuff, okay, with this DNA sample. And they didn't need to get in to the details of the level and the quality of the DNA sample. It was enough for them to just say that he couldn't be excluded as somebody who would have left the DNA. Because what they didn't have on Brumbeck, which they did have in their minds as far as the Hunters, was that Garcia was in town until after he's arrested. After he's arrested, they then got his phones and he had a tablet with them. And at that point, they found that he had, at least according to them, that on the tablet, there had been a search on either Google Maps or just Google for Chandra Butra's address. So mm-hmm. they claim that's on his tablet.
Yeah. And right. Okay. So criminal defense lawyer Bob, I know you say this is circumstantial evidence, but to me, this all just seems like overwhelming circumstantial evidence. Like, there's just thing after thing pointing to
that he was in town, for sure.
Well,
for sure.
Too many coincidences, I think, here.
So and then they get his phone records and they ping him at this Wingstop. Like, so he's at a Wingstop at 3 to 3:15 in the afternoon on Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. And they got that again from pinging, triangulating him. So they had him in this particular area. Like, kind of jumping into how we attacked the tablet search. That's a whole thing, because remember, we're not just going in speculating. We were hiring experts. So we obviously got experts with respect to the technology side of it And, you know, we had them look at, because essentially what they do is when they get anybody's phone, and this is kind of a little tip for y'all out there, all of our wonderful listeners, that nothing on your phone is ever truly deleted.
Oh, okay? Shit.
Anything that you think that you've deleted off of your phone is not. So what they took, when they got a copy of all of his data from his phone and the tablet, they ran it through this thing that law enforcement uses that's called Cellebrite. And what this does is you take a dummy phone, you connect the phone that you're trying to extract the information from and run it into the dummy, the blank phone, the wiped phone, and it brings in all the data from that phone into the wiped clean phone. So through that is where they were starting to see all the deleted information from both the tablet as well as his cell phone. And they didn't find anything on his cell phone. They're like, all that they found in terms of the boot research was on this tablet. All right. So at that point, you know, we had hired an expert to say, okay, take a look at this. And we end up finding out, and this is kind of like, I don't even feel like we can go here at this point because there's so much. It's mm-hmm. like everything that they found, we had a direct answer for. Because okay. I get what you're saying. On its face, it's pretty damning. You know? I mean, the guy apparently seems to have beef. I mean, theoretically, he could, even though I don't think that really adds up in terms of the reality of his situation. You know, you've got him in Omaha for sure through the ping at the wing stop on. So they know that he was again in Omaha on the 13th.
And they have like a trail of receipts and stops between his home and Omaha. So like,
yeah,
right?
So he made a stop in your home state in Iowa at Casey's, mm-hmm. you know, and he had bought a case of beer there. Okay. They also, again, they have him pinged at the wing stop where he spent like $8. It sounds like he bought like a drink, like a cocktail, because they have beverages there. Got like a, you know, some kind of cocktail. I don't know the eight there. And then, you know, where that really gets interesting in the whole Brombeck timeline is where I'm gonna change your mind on it.
Okay.
It's not only, well, I mean, just kind of harken back to when I was talking about the situation under which the state pigeonholed themselves into that killing time between 4:30, 4:45 on that Sunday where mm-hmm. no one hears gunshots.
Right.
No one sees anybody strange in the neighborhood. No one sees anybody shooting into the... And the way that the Brombeck neighborhood was situated is you had a long street. It was like a T. So you had the one cross street at the very top where it was, you know, dead-ended up there. Once you hit the end of the street, you had to either turn left or right. The Brombeck's house sat directly in front of what would be the top of the T. So their house was, if you were to head down their street and look, you know, straight ahead of you, their house would be at the end of the T, you know, right there. Okay. So it was like at the top of kind of the hill a little bit, and straight down, you'd have, you know, the houses on either side of the street. So do you understand how I'm situating this?
Mm-hmm.
So, and these houses were maybe, you know, 12 to 15 yards apart max. You know, I mean, these weren't like palatial lots. You know, it was kind of like it was not as a highfalutin neighborhood as Dundee by any stretch. It was a more modest neighborhood, single family homes. And to not have anyone hear anything, not have anyone see anything. And, you know, when I start really kind of digging into that, you know, and the neighbor directly to, if you're staring at the Brombeck's home, directly to the right of their home was an active Omaha police officer who was actually home that day with his wife, and he didn't hear any gunshots.
He's not a person who would have just thought, oh, it's a firecracker either. He knows a gunshot when he would hear it.
Absolutely. Once. You know, and the state knew that was an issue. So when I'm cross-examining him, you know, kind of their theory was that, you know, his wife's oxygen tank, because she either had COPD, you know, she had something that required her to have a tank that he said would have been hissing, you know. So on cross-examination, I had asked him this question. I said, well, officer, let me ask you this. if a car had been driving in front of your home and had backfired with your wife's tank on, would you hear the backfire from the vehicle? And he said, oh, yeah. The gun that we know from ballistics, we know that it was a 9mm, which is going to give off a pretty loud bang, all right, and four of them. But if you would have heard a backfire from a vehicle, he certainly would have heard gunshots, you know, from,
right,
you know, so it just didn't happen. It didn't happen. But like the biggest smoking gun against their timeline was the, which I'll get into, which was the forensic pathologist that we hired talking about the state of the bodies when they were discovered, because the Brumbecks were, at least according to the state, were killed on Sunday afternoon, not discovered until Tuesday morning, mm-hmm, by some piano movers, because the Brumbecks, right, were, you know, he had a lot of issues at Creighton himself, talking about Roger Brumbeck, mm-hmm, a lot, to the extent where he was leaving the department. You know, there was a lot of big money things that were going on behind the scenes with respect to the university, and you know, people were taking exception to some of the things that were going on. When we get to that, it's pretty compelling. So that's kind of where we're at. I mean, at this point, you've got the Hunters have been killed in 2008. You got the Brumbecks dead in 2013. And from that point forward, they've got those three things on Garcia that was enough to get him under arrest. The cops had made the connection with Garcia, Creighton, found out there are a few smoking gun pieces of evidence out there with respect to him, at the very least being in Omaha. You know, they had pulled this DNA off the doorknob of Boucher's house. You know, they had the CRV. Along with one thing that I forgot to mention is, even though in the 2008, there had been a composite sketch that had been done of the person that the neighborhood folks said that they had seen walking around, you'll have to judge for yourself whether or not you think it looks like Garcia.
Does the sketch have a meaty face like Garcia?
No.
He has a meaty face.
He does. He has a very round, meaty face. And no, like, it doesn't. Like, this guy's face is pretty oval. His nose looks different, like quite a bit different. Like, to me, it's not, you know, it's not a very good representation of Garcia if it was Garcia. But, you know, they had that. So, but at any rate, we're basically at the point where they like Garcia for the Hunter and Sherman killings, and they also like him for the Brumbeck killings. And they certainly had more evidence in terms of, especially because of his, like, that they actually were able to ping him in Omaha for the 2013 killings. So they knew he was there. They knew he was in the state, and they knew he was in Omaha on the day. In terms of both crime scenes, the one thing that, again, did not occur is there is no DNA found. And we're talking about, like, and I'm talking about anything that would have, you know, I think in Brumbeck, there were a few different samples that were taken that did not in any way, shape, or form indicate that it was Anthony Garcia in there. You know, they ran the samples against his known sample, and he was excluded as being, you know, the provider of that particular DNA. So again, you have two crime scenes, both involved violent knife attacks. The gun, you know, was used obviously to kill Roger, so you're not going to really concern yourself with DNA from that perspective. But the violent knife fight with Mary Brumbeck, to me, just seems illogical that, you know, somebody wouldn't leave some kind of sample. And again, you know, the thing that I was talking about with you that I was trying to kind of draw out of you in terms of, like, not leaving DNA on a scene. And, you know, and I asked you and you said, well, you know, I'd have something covering my feet. You know, I'd have something covering my body. You know, that's where, you know, you were like, I'd slick my hair back with Vaseline. You know, I mean, you'd basically try to make yourself hairless and, you know, kind of like cover as much of your skin as possible, because, I mean, even a flake of dry skin is DNA. You know, I mean, it does not take much to leave a sample.
And they can find that? Like,
oh yeah.
How? Well,
so the DNA sample that they pulled from the doorknob of Butra's house, they claim was a drop of sweat. So that's what that sample was, you know.
And okay, so it didn't rule him out.
It but did, like, yeah, the Boutra sample came back super, super weak. And
okay,
kind of the way that you, when you're talking about comparisons, he came back as a 1 in 12 match for that, meaning that 1 in 12 human beings on the planet would match that sample.
Oh, okay.
Like, so it wasn't, it didn't match. There's something called alleles when you're dealing with DNA. And I think that he had matched on like 13 alleles, you know. And so we had hired an expert who's brilliant, brilliant DNA guy named Carl Reich. He was a local guy. We just got lucky that he was local to Illinois. He had the ability to be able to break down DNA to a layman in a way that people could actually understand it. He was adamant that our guy, that was not our guy, you know, and he was able to break down the, you know, kind of the peaks and the alleles and like why, you know, he was able to break it down in such a way that it was clear that that was not Anthony Garcia's DNA. They wanted it to be, you know, they really wanted it to be because it fit their narrative so perfectly. You know, it's like, oh, well, first he tried to go kill Boutra. Boutra wasn't home, so he audibled, and he decided to go kill the Brumbacks instead. You know, and
but a drop of sweat could belong to literally anyone, any delivery person, anybody, right?
For sure. Well, and that's what I'm saying. And that particular sample was a 1 in 12 match to Garcia, meaning that one of the jurors would have also right. been, you know,
yeah,
been
good
able
point.
To not be excluded. It was a very, very weak sample.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like when you're talking about DNA, you want that like 1 in 3 billion. Like mm-hmm. it's just like it can't be anybody else. It's yours.
Right.
You know, this was not that. You know, and further, this guy's MO, if it's Garcia doing both of these things, is not, he doesn't creep around to the back door. This guy walks right up to your front door, rings the doorbell, and commences the killing. Like that's
yeah.
like he wasn't the backyard creeper guy. So just a different MO. Like why would he go to the back door at Boutra's as opposed to doing what he does where he just goes to the front door? And
well, it's not like he had a well-established MO yet either. It was only his second time that we know of. So
yeah, but both times he went to the front door. I mean, that's yeah. established. It's more established than going to the back door.
True.
Right.
And this is where we're going to end part 3 of our deep dive into the Anthony Garcia case with Bob Mata and Darren Wood of the Defense Diaries podcast. We've got 2 more enthralling episodes left in this multi-part series, so you're going to want to check those out and see how this story ends. And if you're still hungry for more about the Anthony Garcia case, well, you're in luck because the Defense Diaries will be doing an entire season of their podcast about Anthony Garcia and his trial. That's right. Season 2 of the Defense Diaries is going to be all about Bob Mata's role in this trial. And you're really going to want to hear that. This is Kelly Behrens-Brink from True Crime IRL signing off and reminding you, until next time, lock your doors, people. Just lock those doors. Bye-bye. True Crime IRL is written, produced, and hosted by Kelly Behrens-Brink. We are part of That's Not Canon Network and TNC Productions in Brisbane, Australia. For more information, go to truecrimeirl.com. True Crime IRL theme music is produced by the Captain at True Crime Garage.